Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
British Nigel May is an all-rounder in the world of entertainment, working on both radio, TV, and as a successful author and podcast host. As a TV host, he has featured on ITV, BBC, Channel 4, and C5, and has also broadcast live from America. He has been a presenter on Craft TV for 2 decades. On radio, he has presented 2 of the sparkliest and glitterest shows on Gaydio. He hosts a weekly Sunday evening show called Wrapping Up the Weekend, which features brand new LGBTQ+ music and top celebrity names dropping in for a chat. On the show, he has spoken to the likes of Dani Minogue, George Takei, stars of Strictly and Dancing on Ice, Matt Goss, Kim Wilde, Bananarama, and many more. On the international drag front, he has spoken to the likes of Jinx Monsoon, Bianca Del Rio, Danny Beard, Jujubee, and again, many more. He also hosts the Saturday Weekend Breakfast Show on Gaydio Brighton. He hosts a successful queer podcast called A Gay Old Time, interviewing celebrities from the LGBTQ+ world. Currently on season 6, guests have included Todrick Hall, Charlie Kondau, Samantha Fox, Hazel Dean, John Barrowman, Maria Margulies, and many more. As an author, he has published 8 novels so far, 6 action-packed glam fiction blockbusters, a sexy six-pack, for which he earned the title the UK's male Jackie Collins. He also published a gripping psychological thriller and a crafty, cozy crime novel. His books have been given countless 5-star reviews and been featured in many national publications. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Nigel May.
Where are you in the world and how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Nice to meet you, Barrett. I am at home in Brighton at the moment. I am in my study where I do a lot of my radio stuff and my podcast stuff and write my books. So this is like my little hub of activity here in Brighton. So yeah, this is my little sanctuary of workspace.
As a child or teenager, at what age were you inspired to think, okay, I want to be in this media entertainment world? And how did that journey progress?
But you know what? I was obsessed with the charts when I was a kid, literally obsessed with magazines and like posters on my wall. And I would listen to the charts every Sunday.
Can I just pause you there? Was that Smash Hits and Number One magazines?
I did get Number One and Smash Hits delivered to my door. Yes, I did. Well done. But yeah, I was, and Lookin' was my magazine back in the day, because I'm late 50s. So it's like Lookin' for me was the magazine that I just loved when I was a child, because it had all the picture strips in it. I've always been obsessed by celebrity, always. I've always been obsessed by music. I mean, the posters on my wall, you know, were Bananarama, were Kim Wilde, were, you know, Thompson Twins. I mean, the 80s for me were just like this beautiful melting pot of music. So yeah, I've always, always, always wanted to be involved in that world. Journalism, which was my sort of entry into the world of celebrity, I suppose, was not actually my first choice, though. I did want to be a vet when I was a kid, and then I did want to be an optician as well. But both of those went out the window. And then I decided on journalism, which is how I kind of got into the celebrity world. Because the first magazine that I went to work for was actually Lookin', which was the magazine that I read when I was a child. So it was a beautiful kind of like full circle moment for me, really.
So what did you do at that magazine?
I was at the college. I went to college in London. I grew up in Gloucester in the West Country of the UK. And then I moved to London to go to the London College of Printing in 1987. And then basically as part of that course, because I did an HND in business studies and journalism, you had to get work experience somewhere. So I got work experience on a magazine called Chat, which was a woman's magazine. And I went to their offices in Knightsbridge, and I loved working there. But The office opposite was Lookin' magazine. And I was like, oh my gosh, I used to love that as a kid. You know, I was so excited to see that it was still out there, still popular. So I wandered into that magazine and asked them if I could do some work experience there. And it was back in the days when literally they just sort of said, yeah, okay, fine. And so I sort of started doing work experience there. And during the second year of my course, it was a 2-year course, I was actually offered a job at Lookin' magazine. So I was very, very lucky to be in the right place at the right time. But I loved it because, I mean, straight away, I was in. It was the era of like Stock Aitken and Waterman Music. So I was interviewing Sunita and Sonia and the Reynolds girls and all of these fabulous people. So it just made me think this is what I wanted to do. And being a showbiz journalist was, well, continues to be. I mean, I love interviewing people. So it's just that started me off on my path into the celebrity media world, I suppose.
What is your definition of a celebrity and how has that changed with social media coming into play?
Interesting. Okay, right. Well, my definition of a celebrity is somebody that has a talent that puts them in a space where other people recognize that talent, whether it be acting, whether it be singing, whether it be dancing, whatever it may be. And I've always been a great respecter of talent. I think, yes, we have lived through an era and maybe continues to live through an era where celebrity doesn't necessarily mean having a talent that gets you recognized. The talent is getting recognized these days. So I think, you know, influencers and people like that, I mean, hats off to them. I mean, I love social media as much as the next person, but I'm a great believer in old school celebrity. You know, I mean, I think part of the joy of me like listening to the charts back in the day was to see somebody going in at number 40 and then rising up to 38 and then going up to 25 and 18 and 12 and 2 and hitting the top spot because there was an excitement of living their journey with them. I think nowadays celebrity is maybe a little bit more easily obtained because celebrity doesn't necessarily mean doing something talented to get you noticed. It's maybe sometimes doing something infamous to get you noticed. You know, and that's no shade to those people. Well done you for getting yourself in that spotlight. But I just think for me, the true definition of a celebrity is somebody that has continued to entertain with their talent for as long as they possibly can. I mean, that's why I love doing the podcast. And the reason I do a podcast called A Gay Old Time is because I love to speak to people of maybe more mature years who have got many, many years of experience and or celebrity under their belt.
Before we get to that, I'm also a person who loves the charts. I remember listening to the charts on the radio. I've got all the encyclopedias, the website that's got the UK charts. I've got all those. Well, I still need to get some of them, those encyclopedias of all the charts. For me, these days, I find the charts a little bit more sort of throwaway. It's just like things come and go. And still, though, I find the UK charts and potentially the Australian charts more loyal in the sense that 10 years ago, Katy Perry in the US would have 8 number ones, one after the next. Now she doesn't even get into the top 100 of the album or of the single charts. Whereas in the UK, yes, maybe she'll have not as many top 10 hits, but she'll still get a top 10 album. And Kylie will continually get number ones and so on and so forth. So there is that loyalty to some artists where I think in the US, it's more loyalty to a genre for a period of time, not necessarily to artists. What are your observations of how the charts have changed over time?
I think we have to throw the word vinyl into the conversation here because I think, you know, back in the day, it would be, say, I don't know, Bananarama would release an album and it would, you know, you'd go and buy it at Woolworths or R Price or HMV or wherever you went to buy it. And you would see it go into the chart the next week and it would be based on that week's sales of that album since it was released. There was no kind of like pre-order unless you went into the shop and said, reserve me a copy. I think these days, you know, if we take Bananarama for example, I mean, when they release an album, and they still release brilliant albums, you know, there will be a red vinyl version, a blue vinyl version, a cassette version, you know, deluxe version, expanded version, a reworked deluxe master version, all of that, which is very clever marketing because it means lots of people, lots of collectors will want to buy things more than once. I mean, I think Taylor Swift is the queen of that, quite frankly. Do I agree with it? Actually, I won't say do I agree with it. Do I think it's the best way to do things? No. But from a marketing point of view and a sales point of view, yes, it probably is. But I think there's a real there's a real noticeable trend with the charts now. If you talk about albums, like somebody will go in top five because they've had all of that pre-sale of their vinyl and all the rest of it, and then they will drop out of the top 100. I mean, I think Kylie, for Tension 2, went in at number one, you know, great album, not as good as Tension, but, you know, good album. And then it dropped out of the top 100 the following week. And that's because that initial rush of loyal fan base that you talked about, Barrett, are there to put it top of the charts. But then there's no follow-up until a deluxe version maybe comes along a few months later with some added tracks or whatever. So there's not that excitement. I mean, a band that I loved when I was a kid, when I was in the 80s, was Dead or Alive. Just loved Dead or Alive. So watching You Spin Me Round, which is still one of my favourite records to this day, to watch that go into the charts after, I think, like 12 weeks on release, and then go in at like number 40 or 39 or whatever, and then watch it climb up the charts to number one. There was such an excitement. And by the time, you know, Pete Burns hit number one, I was such a fan because I'd lived that journey. I mean, loved the music, but also lived that journey with them. And it was one of my first concerts on my own was to go and see Dead or Alive. And just, I just felt part of something. And I know, you know, Taylor Swift has her Swifties and the rest of it. Again, no shade to anybody, but I just think there was much more of an excitement about riding that journey. You know Taylor Swift's new album is going to be number one next week. You know that. It's like there's no doubt about that, whether it's a good album or a bad album. It's a good album, I think. But it's like, you know, there's no doubt that it will be number one because people will buy it. I love it when somebody comes along like Chapel Rowan that kind of like takes everybody by surprise. And it's just like, actually, this album's been out for a long time. Suddenly people are listening to it because Good Luck, Babe, you know, did the business. And then you saw that climb the charts. That for me is the exciting side of the charts. I don't think the charts are as exciting as they used to be, but they still have an exciting element about them.
Yeah. And I agree with back in the day with the charts, when you saw them climbing and you were on that journey with them, there wasn't social media. The only place you'd see interviews with them was maybe on television, Top of the Pop, Smash Hits, Number One, et cetera, et cetera. We weren't seeing what they were having for breakfast. We weren't seeing them, you know, having a picture with the sun, all that kind of stuff. So there's a little bit more mystery to them. And to hear them on the radio, to be part of that journey, you're sort of feeling it with them. Where these days, it's a little bit, oh, I'm seeing them every day, five times, six times a day. So it feels like that sort of climbing the charts sort of periphery.
It's a strange one because obviously that fourth wall that, you know, that's been knocked down now. So it's like you can get to you get to see what people have for breakfast. You know, Beyonce sneezes, everybody knows about it. But I just think that takes away the mystery. And for me, celebrities, I've always, you know, especially when I was younger, I put them on a pedestal. It was like they were aspirational, inspirational. I'm not saying they're not now, but I think if you can see everybody warts and all, as it were, it's easier to, you know, to demystify their allure and just see them as, you know, a human being, which they are ultimately. But I just love the fact that for me now with social media as a member of the public, it's easier to get in contact with celebrities. It's easier. I mean, that's half the thing, you know, I would say the majority of the interviews that I've had on the podcast are with celebrities that I've managed to connect with through social media. So there is definitely pros and cons to social media, but I'm a bit old school in the fact that I like celebrities to have that air of mystique about them, and I think sometimes they're not able to have that. I think the ones that do still remain with an air of mystique, then they're doing something very, very clever, because it's very easy to just literally spew your life onto the internet these days, isn't it?
What do you love and enjoy about doing, creating and hosting interviews?
I've always been nosy, so I am very, very keen to like ask people questions. I like to think interviewing is my superpower, and I don't mean that to sound egotistical. I just feel that it's the cape that I wear best. I just love chatting with people. And even if I don't necessarily agree with somebody's opinion, I'm always respectful of what that person has to say. I don't have to agree with them. If everybody agreed with everybody in life, the world would be a very strange place. But I just love hearing people's stories.
Yeah.
I love hearing how people have dealt with situations because, you know, as a queer man for a gay old time, I can relate to so much that I hear on the podcast from the celebrities that I talk to. Same with my, you know, my radio shows on Gaydio. It's just nice to speak to people that have a commonality with my life. And I just, yeah, I have a great respect for that person. Like I say, I may not always agree with what they are doing in their life or the views that they have, because there's a lot of very varied opinions out there, especially at the moment. But I do feel you have to respect somebody's ability to air their opinion, even if you don't necessarily agree with that opinion. Because my job as an interviewer is to facilitate this person's opinion and their story to a wider audience. So, yeah, I'm not going to be combative with somebody. I think it's clear if I don't like something that I'm not going to agree with it. But, yeah, in the same breath, I'm not going to sit there and be like, I'm not going to try and change somebody's opinion when I'm interviewing them. In real life, that's a different matter. If it's one of my friends that says something, then, yeah, I will be like, well, why do you think that? But I think with people that you are interviewing, people that you have on the podcast, on the radio show, wherever it may be, they are there for a reason, because people want to listen to what they have to say and form their own opinion. So you are there as a vessel for their voice, if you like.
When you're talking just now about when you're with friends and you're asking them why they believe that, that's not about changing their mind. It's just about getting on the same page. Because for me, there's dictionary of definitions, right? Which we went through earlier, which is part of NLP, which is neuro-linguistic programming. So everyone in the world hears, sees, experiences, and processes information differently. And everyone is assuming that everyone is seeing, experiencing, feeling, and processing information the same as them. And that's where most of the breakdowns of information or breakdowns of communication happen. And oftentimes, I'll be speaking to someone and they'll say a word. I'm like, okay, what is your definition of that word? Because my definition is different. And I need to be on the same page with you to understand what your definition is. It doesn't mean I'm agreeing with you or disagreeing with you, just so that, okay, I can sort of get what you're talking about and be on the same page. And again, so many people don't dive deeper than that. And I think that's what you're referencing earlier about asking, why do you believe that? It's not about changing someone's mind. It's not about forcing your opinions on someone else. It's about diving deeper and understanding. And these days, and for the longest time, people just sat on the surface.
I agree. I could not agree more. I mean, I think it's not for me about getting on the same page. It's for just understanding the page that they're on.
Yes. Okay. That's exactly what I meant.
It's for me, it's just about, and for you obviously as well, Barrett, I just think it's about an understanding of that person, whatever they have to say, and trying to find out why they are saying that. I mean, like I say, I mean, with friends, you can try and change their opinion, but 9 times out of 10, you're not going to, because they've already formulated their opinion. And, you know, who's to say that their opinion is wrong and mine is right? It's like, it's different shades. I mean, one of the great things that I love about the queer community is the fact that we have so many great, you know, beautiful facets to it now. Yeah. So, you know, I don't ever want to label people. I don't like labels. I don't ever want to compartmentalize people into, oh, well, you think that, so you're a bad person. No, I think what you're thinking is a bad thing might not necessarily equate to them being a bad person. Sometimes it does. But, you know, I need to have an understanding of their page. I need to hear all of the evidence that has got them onto that page.
Let's dive into different facets. Television presenting.
Yes.
Your experience with that, are you still doing it? What do you enjoy about that?
Yes, I'm still doing it. My actual job in life is a TV host. It's like I've been working on craft TV, shopping television for, probably about 20 years now. I work for a channel called Hobby Maker, which is a craft channel here in the UK. It's on Sky and Freeview and Virgin and Internet and all the things. And I love it because the crafting community is not something that I ever thought I would be part of. I got into it because I used to work for a channel called Ideal World that was a generic shopping channel, a bit similar to like a QVC. And they started a crafting channel. Well, they had a crafting channel. And I kind of became adopted by that because, again, I have a respect for the joy that card and paper and glue and glitter and stamps and dies can bring to somebody. So that's my bread and butter. I mean, I love hosting. I absolutely adore hosting. In another life somewhere, I'm hosting the Eurovision Song Contest. That for me would be the ultimate. But I'm not dissing what I do because I love working on shopping television. I think it's a real skill. There is no script. You know, we have information sheets that we have to learn our product beforehand. It's a really good, solid educational ground for presenting. Hosting is another of those things that I think, you know, as I've done it for many, many years, I don't understand egotistical, but I've learned that I'm good at it. I feel comfortable. It feels a comfortable space for me. I still have that adrenaline before every show. Most of the things that I do are live. So, yeah, I still have that adrenaline and that rush and that want to, you know, succeed with the show, especially with shopping telly. It's all about sales, but also, you know, entertaining, educating, aspiring, inspiring, all of those things. But I just love it. I just, there's such a buzz that still goes through me every time that red on-air light goes on, no matter what the studio is. I love all sorts of hosting. I mean, I've hosted outside broadcasts, and I hosted on a few book events recently for Miriam Margolyes, which was just brilliant in front of a live audience, and things like that. They just fuel my fire. They get me so excited. And I just, again, it's that, I suppose it's that want to entertain. It's the entertainer in me that wants to make sure that people, if they're giving me the privilege of turning on the TV to watch something that I'm on, or if they're reading one of my books, or if they're listening to one of my podcasts or whatever, it's not about me, but I want to make sure for me, because I can only answer for me, because I'm the only one that is me. It's like, I will want to make sure that I do as good a job as possible to make sure that whoever's listening or reading or watching is getting what they want from this particular show or podcast or radio show or whatever. Does that make sense?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's about empowering the listener, whoever's ready to receive that knowledge that they need to be there to get.
For me, it's about informing and sort of like entertaining, but also presenting and making sure that the show goes fluidly. And, you know, because obviously when I'm hosting on shopping telly, I will have a guest with me, and quite often that guest is the owner of the company whose product we are selling. So I feel that there's a real, well, privilege for me to be doing it, but also there's a real, not pressure, but there's a real, what's the word? There's a real want for me to make sure that I do the best for them. Because, you know, I mean, if I didn't care, I could just walk away at the end of the show and be like, oh, that didn't do well, or that made lots of money or whatever. But I do care. I want to make sure, because it's somebody's business, that if I'm the person representing their business for that hour by imparting information to people out watching, that I do as good a job as possible. So I wouldn't say it's a pressurized job because I love it so much, but I would say that I put pressure on myself to make sure that I do everything I can to walk away from that show knowing that I did everything I could to make it sell.
From television to radio. You referenced you're on Gaydio.
I am, yes, that's true.
So how,
the UK's largest LGBTQ plus radio station.
We don't have one in South Africa yet. I need to tune into the UK one. So anyway.
Oh, please do. Please do. It's all over the app and the internet.
How long have you been on the radio for? How did that come to be, and tell us more?
Okay, that's a good story, because I basically, I did hospital radio years ago, back in the days when it was like put the 7-inch record on the thing, move the needle across and all of that. So I did that when I was in my 20s, and then I moved down to Brighton with my partner about 9 years ago now, 2016. And I was aware of a channel called station called Gaydio. Basically, it's broadcast across certain areas in the country, now national as well. But at that point, it was one of the areas where it was prolific was Brighton. So I was hearing more of it. And I just thought, you know, I love this station. I love what it stands for. Very proud to be, you know, a queer individual. But also, at that stage, I was 40, late 40s. And I just thought, you know what? There's a definite feeling of like young on this station. And I just wanted to be part of it and be representative of older queer people. And I got in touch with a guy called Matt Crapp, who was one of the hosts on the on Gaydio at that point. We'd followed each other on social media and stuff. And I sort of said to him, I really want to work for Gaydio. I really want to work for Gaydio. And he was like, well, you know, you never know. And it's like, we might be doing something in Brighton. And then they opened an office, a studio in Brighton. So I met up with one of the bosses when he was down here, asked if I could come in for a meeting. I was chatting away, just like you and I are now. And then Toby, the guy, said at the end, well, what would you like to do? And I was like, I'd like to do a show for you. And he was like, well, okay. And he was like, can you work a desk? And I was like, no, I haven't worked a DJ desk for like the long, well, I've never worked a DJ desk. Back in the day, it was like a say with a record player. So I was like, okay. So they gave me like a crash course in that. And then I ended up hosting a overnight show, 2 a.m. till 7 a.m. in the morning on a Monday. Yeah, it was pre-recorded, I'm not going to lie. So I did that for a while. And then various things happened with pandemics and stuff like that. And I was doing a Saturday morning show for a while for Gadio Brighton with a co-host, and then we couldn't work together during the pandemic, so that kind of like changed the dynamic for a while. Long story short, I ended up then, they asked me if I would do a Sunday night national show called Wrapping Up the Weekend, which I still do, which is every Sunday night. And I also now do Weekend Breakfast for Gadio Brighton as well. Gadio is a voluntary job. I'm a volunteer on Gadio, but I absolutely adore it as a station because, as I say, I love what it represents. I love the music. It's banging dance tunes. I mean, very happy with that. But also, I just love, I mean, I get to interview people on there. They never asked me to incorporate interviews onto the show. That was something I chose to do myself. And luckily, it's been well received, well accepted. And I just feel I'm very proud that I've kind of made that show, well, both shows, what they are, really. And I just feel, again, I hope they entertain. I mean, I live in Brighton, so quite often people will say, like, oh, I listen to you on a Saturday morning. And that, for me, is just such a joyous thing. And I've been with Gadio for probably about 7-8 years now, maybe 7 years, 6-7 years. And I'm just super proud of it. Super proud of it as a station, the way that it's grown. Super proud for my involvement in the station. It takes up a lot of my time, I'm not going to lie, but I have absolutely no problem with that because I enjoy every moment of it. I love talking to people, and, you know, being Nigel from Gadio is something that I'm very proud of. So long may it continue, because I really love working for Gadio.
Your podcast, Gay Old Time, is that
correct? Gay Old Time, yes, A Gay Old Time. So what available on Amazon or wherever you get your Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast fix right now.
Adding that in, where, how, and what was inspiration to start it?
Okay, so the inspiration for it was, as I say, it was initially like an age thing, in the fact that I had the title of Gay Old Time in my head, and I thought, I want to speak to celebrities about their queer life journey, but I wanted it to be people that weren't just like, oh yeah, I came out last week, or, you know, 2 years ago, whatever. I wanted it to be people of the old, in inverted commas, if you like, so at least in their 30s and above, and, you know, have had a few sort of ups and downs along the way. I think it came about really because I'd had lots of interviews on Gadio where, I mean, obviously on a radio interview, it's like you can speak to somebody for like half an hour, but you have to like cut it down to about, you know, 2-3 minutes tops. Yes. And so there's a lot of beautiful stuff that never gets heard. And I just thought, well, this would be a really good way to actually go deeper with people, go more in depth with the conversation. So the idea was born for a Gay Old Time. And I started doing it. And then I said to Gadio, I've got this podcast that I'm about to launch. They like the idea. So they house it on their website and their app, as well as it being on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and all the rest of it. And it's like, yeah, I'm now 6 seasons in. I've just finished season 6. And then I will probably take a short break before season 7 comes back. But I'm just, again, super proud because I feel that the podcast is putting good out there, in the fact that there are stories that people can relate to. There are people that maybe see themselves in a situation that maybe the person being interviewed has been in before, whether it's, you know, trauma about potentially coming out, worry about their workmates or colleagues or their family not taking it the right way. And seeing that there is, you know, sometimes triumph over adversity. I mean, again, because I love speaking to people, I just love hearing people's stories. When I go into an interview for a Gay Old Time, it's always, you know, I have my set plan of questions, if you like. I know what I want to ask, and I will always research to the nth degree because that's the ultimate respect. But I do think, in the same breath, it's like, if you have to deviate off that path and just see where people go with the story, you have to be respectful, because it's not always easy for people to talk about their coming out journey or talk about, you know, when they were feeling shameful of their sexuality or were dealing with it in a harmful way or whatever. So, yeah, I think it all comes down to respect for me with a Gay Old Time. I want to hear people's story, but I want to hear the story that they are prepared to tell,
yeah,
and that they're prepared to share. So, but I'm super proud of it. I mean, I would love, my dream, if I could manifest anything, would be for a Gay Old Time to go out on the road and just sit on a stage and interview somebody about their life and just hear their glorious story in front of a live audience. That I would love. I mean, nothing pleases me more than people coming back and saying, I loved listening to your, you know, your interview with Todd Recall, or I loved listening to your interview with Miriam Margolyes or whoever it may be, because I got something from it. I didn't know that about them. Nothing pleases me more than if a celebrity during the interview says, I don't think I've said this before, but that for me is just like the ultimate pride, because I just feel, yeah, if you feel blessed enough to be able to share this with me and share this with the audience, then that is, that really is a beautiful thing.
Let's head into your books. At what point did you think, okay, I want to write a book? And how did that journey start?
I started writing books at the, it was about 2007, 2008. I basically was, I kind of given up journalism. I'd kind of given up working for magazines. I worked for magazines for a long, long time, newspapers. And then I got into, when the internet boom came along, I ended up working for a company called Where It's At as their showbiz editor on their website. So I was putting like the website pages together for the entertainment section. And they launched a TV channel. And through a strange but very fortuitous series of events, I ended up hosting on that channel, because I ended up training the presenters they had, who were a lot younger than me, about interviewing people. And then my bosses were like, oh, we like what you do. Would you consider hosting on the TV? And I was like, well, let me think about that for a while. Yes, of course, I'd love to. When I'd always wanted to do TV. It's like TV was something that I'd always wanted to do from my days of, you know, watching Top of the Pops when I was a kid. It's like, you know, I want to be doing this. So when I got the opportunity to do that, I did. And we did a live show every weekend from the Trocadero in London called May Day. And I absolutely flipping loved it. It was brilliant. But books. So basically, I went to, I was doing my TV stuff, and I'd moved into shopping telly at that point. And I had a shift pattern that was 4 days on, 4 days off. And I just thought on those 4 days, I thought, I miss writing. I miss writing. So I thought, well, okay, why don't I try writing a novel? So I thought, well, what kind of novels do I like? I grew up with like Jackie Collins and I grew up with those kind of novels. So I thought, well, I want to do some kind of like drama-filled blockbuster, create these characters, very Dynasty, very Dallas, very like, you know, American soap opera. And that's when I started writing my first novel, Trinity, about the three girls and all of the things. Do you remember Lace, the miniseries?
Yes.
See, I was obsessed with that. Shirley Conran, absolutely obsessed with her and her books and that miniseries. So I just wanted in my head to create that miniseries or a miniseries in print, in my head. So in my head to go into print. So I just started writing Trinity on my days off. And then I sent the first three chapters off to an agent. Lots of agents, didn't hear anything back. Ended up writing the rest of the book and then heard back from an agent saying, oh, we like your first three chapters. Are you any nearer the end? I was like, well, I've just finished it now. So I kind of got signed to them. I never got a publishing deal off it, though. So I ended up self-publishing in the end. Self-published the first two books. I wrote Trinity and Addicted. And then I got offered an online deal by a company called Bookature for six books. And then that's when I did my like six blockbusters. And that started my journey into writing. Now, I've now written nine books, various genres, everything from like my latest one is like a comedy murder mystery set at a Eurovision style contest. Because Eurovision is my happy place. And I just, you know, I love it. And I've written a psychological thriller. I wrote a cozy crime based around a craft group, because obviously that's very close to my home with my TV work. And then the six blockbusters. I mean, again, if I could manifest anything, it would be one of the blockbusters becomes a Netflix, you know, miniseries or drama or something, because there's some fabulous characters in those books, if I say so myself. If you are a fan of like Dynasty and Joan Collins and that kind of like dripped in glamour and dripped in drama kind of soap opera, then yeah, my books delivered that, I hope. I still have, you know, quite a loyal fan base to those books, which is lovely.
Well, let's put it out there that all these things that you referenced earlier will manifest on the stage, on the TV, in front of the TV, and all the rest.
Now, boy can dream, Barrett. Boy can dream.
Well, let's put it out there.
Okay.
The podcast is listened to throughout the world. As a final message, what would you like to say?
I would like to say to anybody that's listening to the podcast right now, just believe in yourself. Believe. I mean, it sounds as naff as old Nelly, but you know what? I have definitely been on a journey, I feel, since the start of the podcast, or my podcast in particular, A Gale Time, since getting that out there and seeing the reaction that it's had and continues to have and hopefully continues to grow. It's made me a very proud person. And I just think for anybody who's out there, whoever doubts themselves and thinks, that can't be me. Because for a long time with the podcast, I thought, I'm too old to do a podcast. I'm too old for this. I'm too old for that. You know, I did think initially, maybe I'm too old for Gaydio. I just think, no. If you know that you can bring something to the table, whatever it is, whatever your profession, whatever you are wanting in life, give it a go. Because the one thing that I don't ever want to do in my life personally is regret not trying something. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. Not everything in life can work, because if it did, then we'd all be sat on a beach with a lot of money in our pockets probably. Mm. But I just think, no, if you want to do something, give it a go. There is somebody doing what we want to do in life, and they've earned that right to do it. But it doesn't mean that you haven't got the right to do exactly what you want to do as well. It's like, I do think, yeah, I'm a great believer of, you know, manifestation. I'm a great believer in just not taking no for an answer from yourself. We all have those voices in our head, don't we, saying, you can't do that. Well, you can't control your first thought, but you can definitely control your second thought. And your second thought should be, why not? Why can't I do that?
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.